thought of the actual coup d'etat in 1922, and therefore 10 years later was still searching in many ways for its own identity. For that 10-year celebration of the fascist takeover of Italy, an exposition was arranged, a grand exhibition in Rome, of course, in the capital of the country, that had only been established some 90 years, had only a history of some 90 years as a modern nation, being a latecomer to that club. In Rome in 1932, that is to say a decade after the establishment of fascism formally by the march to Rome, an exhibition was held under the title Decennale, or the decade, meaning the first 10 years of the government. And indeed, this exhibition, which ranged widely and was expected to illustrate the effect, the profound changes wrought in every aspect of Italian lives and institutions, it embraced also one grand room, the so-called Sala O, or the Room A, alphabetically as they were lettered as you went through, that in a sense was conceived of as a kind of grand dynamic theater in which those forces that led to this turning point in Italian history were to be represented in the most immediate fashion. For instance, in that wave of raised hands, which no doubt will recall to you Clutis's poster, and I'm absolutely sure that not only because of the white propaganda that Russian suprematist art received in Western Europe, but specifically in this instance by an interest in the techniques, in the sense of mass manipulation and of the creation of new political imagery, Terragni must have been fully aware of Clutis's work, as he himself in fact used the hand not in the classic fascist salute, which would have been the clenched fist, but used it in that ambivalent and, as we know, within a few years, officially established fascist salute as it was adopted by the Nazi Party. In other words, we have here the phenomenon of the individual testifying and joining by that testimony a mass of people so large that, in fact, in the lower parts of the image, the mass as a subject begins to manifest itself, and the big helical propellers show that image of mass motion, of the irresistible advance of the masses, as if they were rolling forward unhalted in a mechanical movement that itself had something threatening and warlike about it. Of course, there were key phrases, catch terms like adunate, which means come together, assemble, and there is a handwritten note of Mussolini, which was to recall the fact that all of this was set in motion, presumably, I mean, in the terms of the propaganda, by the leader of the country, the Duce himself. So this is the larger context of a building that is to serve the institutions of the state, but in there, an interesting shading of that life of institutions. It was to be the party and the various para-political institutions, which began with providing counsel for the unemployed, distributing welfare from the coffers of the party rather than from those of the finance ministry of the state, for gathering of the members of the party and of the public at large in order to assist speeches, conferences, projections of films, public ceremonies on particular days, as of course you would expect in a moment here, where Terani himself, and we come to that when he published The Building, did indeed repeat here what he had already rehearsed in the big exhibition of 1932. Namely, he made the people, the mass of Italians, form a kind of sea, almost waves of masses of people with the massive dominance of the black color, because it was the black shirts, in short, that constituted the early fascist squadristi, or those groups that pioneering platoons of the coming regime were playing havoc in many of the traditional institutions. So here, camicie nere, the black shirts, are the ground upon which this building, in a sense, seem to float, seem to ride on the masses. And another interesting contrast which already emerges here, and there are many more of that kind that we will look into, was that the astounding contrast, obviously heightened by the montage in the negative and by the particular reproductive photographic treatment, the contrast between black as the synonym of party and people and white as the nature, the innate nature of the building itself, a building which thereby claims its place in 20th century architecture by virtue of its pristine and nearly white quality, a quality that here is moreover, and we'll look into this too in greater detail, identified with the material nature of the stone that has been used in order to clad completely this building. So if the building presents itself, therefore, as a pristine modern building in which a flawless material of uniform kind guarantees, as it were, or stands in for the integrity of the entire building, then the dominant black in the masses of people stand for the consolidated power, stand for the solid basis and union of the Italian people, who for centuries, if you look back, have of course been in one form or another clamoring for that kind of unity that would assure them the status of a nation, and that in this particular case would now open the future of that nation towards a modernity represented by the building as kind of culminating object, a modernity that had been so sorely lacking in previous for previous generations. I pointed out last time that buildings of this institutional nature need to invoke, precisely because they would otherwise not manifest any such identity, they need to invoke images, emblems, figures, qualities that are direct analogies to the presumed nature of the institutions they represent. So just how a building in the early 1930s might become not only instantly recognizable as the seat of the party, called the Casa del Fascio, the home of the party. The word casa, in that sense, has the immediate association not so much to building in a generic category as to home. Casa mia, facciamo così, which means casa mia is where I belong, where I'm from. So the very use of the term casa, instead of, for instance, palace, palazzo, which might already distance it somewhat, not to use conventional vocabulary, but would have, identified the seats of power, but to use Gaza was to foreshorten that relationship, which puts every single person in the mass of the people into an immediate relationship to power, however invisible that relationship may be. So when this building was premeditated and built, one did really not yet know what a Casa del Fascio was to be, what its symbols, names, and emblems might be appropriate for it. As every Casa del Fascio was to serve a specific community, here the community of Como, again in an image deliberately chosen by Terragni in his publication, about which I'll say something in a moment, and therefore circled in white in the photograph that otherwise gives you a comprehensive overview of the geography, a geography which has its own extraordinarily interesting history, which currently even includes George Clooney, who has decided to buy three houses on Lake Como, and the second to our latest Star Wars episode had that ludicrous marriage ceremony in a Photoshop-enhanced version of a big villa, which is also on Lake Como. So Lake Como not only has a long tradition on the English imagination, on the Anglo-Saxon desire for something Italian that is perhaps not yet as threatening as the Italian nature of the South. It's still closer to the Alps, the classic moment of sublime experiences, and embraces both mountains and spaghetti, and therefore, in a sense, satisfies all comers. So this choice on the part of Terragni of a building that was to serve a specific community, rather than only represent a supra-regional or state power, if you want, such as, for instance, a central bank or a state hospital might imply, that it represents in the first place a state authority rather than a local community, here for the Casa del Fascio, in fact, to do nothing but to ratify the choice of Casa, it needed to be defined in terms of a locality. So while useful models of central state institutions were particularly scarce in a nation that had only been unified, as I said, in 1860, local models, of course, existed in abundance. In such structures as, for instance, the ancient basilica, I reminded you, the law courts since Roman antiquity, the medieval town halls or palazzi della ragione, the various seats of judicial power in the palazzi del podestà, the podestà being the impartial highest judicial authority in any one town. Now, because the fascist state was established, as I said, only gradually after 1922, taking a considerable time to penetrate existing institutions and to assert its own authority over tradition, it cast about rather haphazardly in search of useful models. It took more than a decade, in fact, to go from emblems such as the colors, for instance, we've seen banners and slogans like Adunate would be such a slogan, or perhaps the most famous one is Obey, Fight, and Win, Ubbedire, Combattere, Vincere, to appropriate schemes of this kind for the layout of a party building, of a school, of the layout of a public square. And it is with this didactic purpose in mind that one could say, precisely reflecting both the quandary and the deep desire to reach such a new identity for the building, that Terragni here made a photo montage where he divided, first of all, the timeline into medieval times, Renaissance, and Tempi Nostri, our times. It's very interesting that he chose what in the mind of most people were two glorious periods in Italian history, medieval times, the time of the independent communes, the city-state, some of them like Milan, even resisting imperial hegemonical ambitions, and others. And of course, the Renaissance that everybody in the world knew was the birth of the great individual, acting independent of institutions and taking shape in the form of a condottiere, of the great scholar, of the great theologian, and so forth. And then they've been Austria, make of it what you may. It doesn't attribute anything else but the presentness. And of course, it now gives to each one of these times, like a single caption, the quintessential building for medieval times, tower and town hall, torre and broletto. For the Renaissance, the grand church edifices, if you think of St. Peter's, if you think of the Cathedral of Florence, the Duomo. And for modern times, and here the ambition is naked and direct, Casa del Fascio. The Casa del Fascio is to play the same role that the grand church buildings of the Renaissance and the outstanding public institutions and public buildings of medieval times did play. Now, if you look for one moment to the picture on the left, you have that duo, or perhaps we could call it a trio, of medieval and Renaissance examples locally. Again, notice how extremely local the focus is in Como itself. Namely, there is raised upon powerful posts, and so you can walk underneath without interrupting the flow of traffic in the streets, the town hall, the big assembly hall with the large windows upstairs in the middle. And you have at its flank, as more as a symbol than anything of immediate obvious purpose, the tower, the torre. The tower, of course, had bells that would signal. It would be the central communication point, if you the clock expressing that, to this day. So you have the tower, and attached to it, the town hall. Remember that. That creates kind of an L-shaped configuration. Then you have, as a big centerpiece, both in historical terms and in architectural ones, the Duomo with its cupola. And finally, looking from the top of the Duomo and on the right-hand picture, you are at the foot of the cupola, and you're looking straight over so that you can get the whole of the Casa del Fascio right there caught in the picture. Now, this is a kind of, if you want, very imaginative history fiction. This is how Terranni couches his building. It is as if you presented a project and you present, Brunelleschi and Mies van der Rohe as a relatively significant precedent for what you have in mind yourself, right? So this is an incredible ambition is here articulated, which is of course not only personal, but it is also the ambition of tempi nostri to bring us back, to make us as powerful and if possible, to make us greater. Then in our finest moments in history, in medieval and Renaissance times. So here is both an incredible political program, right, and at the same time a kind of construction of a framework for the architecture that we can never again, in a sense, or we're not, according to this optic, allowed to look at, closing our eyes to medieval and Renaissance times. What is equally important, of course, is that this is not a dry page from an architectural history. It is most of all to recall the fact that buildings like the medieval town hall and tower and others had authority, exercised authority as the seats of civic institutions, and to recognize not only their role in civic life, but also their place in the town's geography, which in the case of Como packed a good deal of public significance into a tight circle of distinctive features. The town had been, if you recall, looking back, you can very clearly make out in the middle, I hope at least the picture's not particularly good, but you can see the Duomo without trouble, you see the Casa del Fascio, you may even see the white tower above my finger of the town hall, and you see the somewhat corroded, but still very evident checkerboard pattern of the Roman town that had been established here before the advent of those modern times or before the Christian era. So Como's location in a valley between the lake and steeply ascending mountains offered numerous points of reference in its geography, and as we've just seen, it offered significant connections to significant distinctive buildings in the town. So Terranni took the trouble of detailing his considerations when he published the Casa del Fascio as soon as the building was finished in 1936. There would be much to say about this publication, and at a later point we may return to this when we look at a couple of publications that I would like you to take note of as the important stepping stones in the evolution of modern architectural publishing. When he published this building, claiming for it an entire special issue of the journal Quadrante in 1936, so at the minimum, in fact, some of the photographs show that the building is barely finished. But I want only to single out some points with regard to Terranni's desire to locate his project within the horizon of Core, although, as I said, the political rationale of the building was divided. It was both national and fascist in its fundamental purpose, and it was, of course, to give a local face and a local reality to that. So anchoring the Casa del Fascio in the urban geography of Como and representing it in splendid photographs taken by his close friend Ico Parisi went hand in hand. This is a shot of Terranni, who was almost 2 meters tall, with the man facing him, of course, a photograph with a light bursting into the building so that their silhouettes are almost either dissolving, like in Terranni's case, or sharply out, like in Bontempelli's case. Bontempelli, the short fellow here, was the editor of the journal Quadrante, a very interesting writer, prolific and very underestimated Italian writer of the 20th century, and Terranni standing next to him, inspecting, as he did with very many other people, the Casa del Fascio when it was barely finished. So he anchored the Casa, we said, in the urban geography and had it, and we'll see more of those, represented in photographs of an extraordinarily telling and new nature. All four facades of the Casa del Fascio differ from one another, and you see them all four here, even though I'm really very sorry for circumstances we have to do with the messy part of my life and with the difficulties that we encounter locally and other things. These pictures can, of course, not by any stretch of the imagination do justice to a building of such exquisite quality that one might say almost miraculously. Notwithstanding a number of traces of damage, looks infinitely better preserved than this building certainly does, even today. You see the four facades of the building, the principal facade facing the old town, that is what you would have on top left, in fact, seen across the railroad tracks. This one exhibits the most complete detached grid of posts and lintels, or of floor levels, forming a series of stately loggias. If you call back, I think, perhaps this comes out most clearly in this photograph. The tableau-like nature of this facade, which turns a conventional element of the loggia, that is to say, of a covered balcony-like area that is, however, taken back from the level of the facade, a very, very old motif in building, into something like the key feature, and the key feature to such an extent that it reads no longer as a series of loggia, at least at first sight, but it reads as a kind of grid structure that seems to be only contained within the maximum frame of the building's own volume. This is a very interesting and curious phenomenon for which there may be, as for others, a number of different explanations. But one explanation which I proffer to you is this building from the early photograph that you have seen is overlooking the entire town. Remember, there it is, standing both beyond the immediate medieval perimeter of the city, of which a lot remains in former city walls, and facing the Duomo as a kind of mirror image. These two buildings, as in that photo montage, face each other, so we can almost say stare each other down. That in this, from this particular point of view, one can read that grid structure of the facade on the left as a kind of town plan of Roman origin raised into the vertical and offered up like a plan drawn on a tablet. That's, I think, what may be one of the intentions of this facade that confirms both its purpose as an image of the building, image detached to the point where, in fact, it might be all you remember or all you see from a certain point of view, an image, moreover, so clearly intended by Perani that he did everything in that earlier montage with all the black shirts in front to, in fact, make that the stamp-like characterization of the building, that the building here, in a sense, does conjure up Roman antiquity, that is to say, the broader spaces of Italian power and continuity in its facade, which is like the plan of the entire town raised to the vertical, and it then begins to go through its rehearsal of medieval, Renaissance, and modern elements. But do recall that there is, on the right-hand side of that facade, even more astounding for the regularity of the other three quarters or so of surface, a sharply set off and totally undivided in any way, a section that goes straight through as a blank surface from the bottom to the top. Why this blank surface? I think for an answer, we can look back into the early stages of the project, where we'll discover that Terranni, and here I may have to, first toyed, and you see it in a sketch of his on top, first toyed with the possibility of shaping his new building, not just in symbolic, but in direct physical analogy to the town hall. Remember, the town hall was a tower to the left, and then the town hall attached. Here he does his town hall, if you want, and the tower attached to the right. So that, in fact, the two moments, medieval history would have made an L like that, modern tempi nostri makes an L like this, and in the middle you would have the Duomo as the sacred cow of architectural history of Como as a kind of balancing point between these two. I propose to you to look fundamentally as he jettisons the idea of the tower, to look at that blank space as some kind of residual manifestation of the fact that, like with the medieval combination of tower and town hall, in the modern combination, of the Casa del Fascio with its originally intended tower would form complements, almost bookends, in that history that the photo montage was suggesting as the very ratifying rationale for the entire project. The town hall, moreover, is raised, as you might recall, off the ground and supported by massive piers. At its side rises the communal tower, and the two buildings form that L-shaped ensemble I mentioned. But only since 1926, because in 1926, the tower was peeled out, or the stump of a tower was peeled out of houses that over the centuries had been constructed around it, and it was raised to its presumed medieval height. So it was itself the product of a 1920s deliberately local restitution of the image of the city of Como in its own history, and it wasn't an actual survivor of medieval times. That is itself very interesting, you know. You'd be surprised if you, and of course one can fortunately demonstrate that, not only in many sketches, but increasingly since the middle of the 19th century, in photographs. If you travel to Florence in 1850 or 1860 or 1870, you would have gotten a significantly different impression of that town, not to mention others in Italy, that had become the subject of extraordinarily elaborate campaigns of restitution in a pre-modern situation where one did not hesitate to put there what one fancied may have been there or should have been there. So Venice was rendered much more medieval in the 100 years between 1850 and 1950 than it ever was, because Ruskin and many other visitors who rhapsodized about Venice as this fairy tale city that miraculously survived as the proverbial fable of medieval times simply have no room where it was possible to for other later transformations. And of course, this mentality has led to the point where today you can barely put a drain pipe into a house in Venice without having literally posses of guardians of the past descend upon you. I speak from experience. So in Terani's triad of times and buildings, the medieval tower and town hall stand next to one another, and in symmetrical correspondence, Terani accompanied the Casa del Fascio with the tower to its right, completing the intended correspondence between the ages in a symmetrically arranged architectural figure. The illusion was too direct, obviously, the point too flat-footed, and Terani discarded the idea. But this, and this is the crucial point, of course, he preserved a record of an idea, even if the idea itself was scuttled. And step by step, Terani carried into the inner workings of the building what had, at first try, been assembled with and around it. And I think you can see that very well looking at these four facades for a minute, taken when the building was barely finished. Keep in mind that they correspond in the following fashion. The front of the building, you recall, is on the upper left, the back of the building, still allowing you along the side street to capture just the top on the lantern of the Duomo, which faces the main facade. You're looking from at the back facade. And then from the back facade, on looking from the back, the right-hand flank and the left-hand flank are represented in the diagonal from lower left to upper right. Now, every single motif, every single part of the structure is recorded or partly suspended, partly cancelled or substituted by other parts, so that, for instance, the back facade exhibit a kind of quasi-symmetry that is very different from the deliberate asymmetry, which I've tried to explain, on the main facade. just as it takes no trouble recognizing that, for instance, the facade on the in the lower right-hand image, the facade to your left along the side, is so fundamentally different in its nature from the one on the other side of the building as to suggest immediately a number of mechanisms that have brought about those differentiations. Just as, for instance, from the front, the only thing we're given is the fact of the accumulated stories. We're given not a shred of evidence for how you go to the upper stories. In the back, not only does the central with twin little stair podests, the tripartite opening in the middle immediately suggest a continuity to the three central openings in the main facade, and indeed, it is like a shotgun structure. You go straight through and out in the back, or the reverse. Whereas here, in the back, you can see through two full stories, a glazed vertical strip, slightly extruded from the facade, which houses the stairwell in the rear, the narrower of the two stairwells, while the wider one is entirely fenestrated from the side and otherwise completely hidden from sight in the blank part of the principal facade. And so you could go through the entire building, take any one single element, and you will immediately see how it changes its nature, its appearance, and therefore its role within the whole. How, for instance, in the front, the vertical posts and the horizontal slabs of the stories form a grid-like, separate screen in front of the facade, whereas in the back, the volume of the building absorbs the posts and absorbs almost completely the division of the stories, thereby giving to the back an altogether different configuration, just as, for instance, the distance, the shallow balcony of the front facade is, of course, recorded, as it is here, just at the edge, as a tiny vertical slot, just wide enough to allow, from the front offices, people to step out on the facade. And indeed, they did step out of the facade, as you recall, when you look here, and you can see the people lined up on the various parts of the loggia. As a way of thinking through a design, Terragni inaugurated what might be called multiple scoring of every move. And I mean this in quite the literal sense of the word. The scoring means you make a mark, you cut into a surface, or it means what are marks cut or notated on a scored surface, a musical score. And in a musical score, any move, any change you make will, in a sense, create reverberations, adjustments, coincidences, and their opposite in every other thing. Change one sound in a vertical chord that's distributed to different voices, and you either get a totally different chord now, which presupposes others, chords before and after, or you get a kind of fixed moment where something is either out of scale, out of whack, out of order, or in an otherwise inexplicable. So it's no surprise that an architect like Peter Eisenman took up this subject and made it for over 40 years a staple of analysis and reflection. And at some point, perhaps equally exasperated as enthused by this exercise, which he conducted for such a long time, he declared, "Terragni does not exist. I've invented Terragni. I am Terragni." And this is a wonderful triad, which in a sense tells us as much about the object as about the architect Eisenman. And it says that Terragni does no longer exist because I have penetrated these mechanisms. I've devoted hundreds and hundreds of analytical plates to show how, from nothing, you arrive at this particular result. And though you may dispute one or another of these moves, or you may think they're overplayed or they're exaggerated in their internal consistency, although there are some that are quite inconsistent, you cannot refute the fact that only Eisenman has, in a sense, been able to unravel and to reconstruct as a series of such ramified steps the entire structure of this book. I won't take your time. Take the Terani book and look through them. And if you can walk straight after having looked through them, better for you. The second point I have invented, Terani is indeed true, because nobody had understood how Terani worked in this fashion, although the evidence that he did work in this way is ample and abundant in the Terani archive. He was an aficionado of the pre-scored sheet, of course, the millimeter red scored pages, and there are many, many, many instances where even down to a very small scale, he would figure out exactly if the move over and down a bit created a series of corresponding moves over and up a little and so forth in other parts of the building. So that whatever happens in any one part of the building, somehow, as I said, in analogy to the musical score, will have consequences for other parts. So the detail, to detail the nature of such scoring and the relevance of this analogy, I think is itself an extremely interesting exercise. Whatever is done to anything is registered in other things. This is a fabulously interesting concept that presents a hypothesis about a building as truly a completely integral order. That is to say, nothing can be changed or disturbed within it without a consequence of that in other parts of the building. So the design grows in density and in internal ramification until nothing, in the sense, is altogether left alone. And you can see that very well. I won't take too much of your time, but you can notice another thing very well in the plans, both on the ground floor and in the first upper floor. And that is, of course, that you will immediately detect that the regularity of the bay, the regularity of the individual intervals, is twice modified, both in the horizontal, looking at the plan, and in the vertical. So that what turns out to be the L shape of the corridor, it turns out to be something of a different caliber, literally of a different width, and correspondingly of a different density in its absorption of element than the others. You can see that very well in the open internal glazed over courtyard, the glazed courtyard. Recall those two little stairs leading out to the back there, right on top, and recall that vertical glazed stairwell, which is the part that protrudes on the upper plan, just a little bit to the end of that narrow bay, which in turn accounts for the fact that the blank part of the wall in the facade, namely the part drawn in black at the bottom to the right-hand side, does not, in its dimensions, correspond to the regular intervals that are otherwise spelled out in the grid of the facade itself. Then notice that everywhere, except in the open courtyard, in the courtyard, of course, on the upper story, the individual posts or pillars are always absorbed into the horizontal slabs or are embedded in wherever our walls may have been moved up to them, on them, beyond them, and so forth. That there is one here in the corner office, which traditionally is the good office, right? And it's not only wider than the other offices, but it is the office that looks out onto the towards the Duomo, and that occupies, that anchors that corner. Here we have that black square indicating the freestanding post, that goes straight through the office. Now, there is also the boardroom, if you want, with a long table and the seats that it communicates, not directly but indirectly, with this office, so that these two are the key features. The boardroom is for the assembly of those that represent the party power, and this place is for the secretary of the party, who, as we know, the term secretary in other political contexts is the executive, and the local, the highest local representative. Hence, the secretary is called the federal secretary, or segretario federale, or the council for brief, il federale, which means the one who represents the whole in locality, rather than is the highest only on the local level. Now, the office of the federale, is the subject of a very interesting photomontage, which is put across from the desk to that dark vertical post and along the windows that we can see here again in the upper part. But the Federale sits beneath the image of Mussolini, of course accompanied on a movable panel by another photomontage of an adunanza, of a big political gathering, and in the bottom part, an extraordinary photo with some montage is made by Ico Parisi that gives an image of the glass table designed by Terragni for the Segretario Federale. And on the right-hand edge of the lower photograph, you could just make out what is the central image on the wall in the upper photograph, the table having been moved 90 degrees, and that is the image of Mussolini. The papers laid out on the table below, in a sense, are as if the word from the image had collapsed down onto the table, and the Federale is the link between the two, and of course, he would dictate something to somebody seated in front of a typewriter, and the typewriter is the latest, the model Olivetti, wonderfully designed portable typewriter, that here becomes a kind of emblematic image of this new mission that words have, that the machine plays. The machine plays for the words, and so forth, and it is no coincidence, of course, that the entire image has been so calculated as to render a mirror image of the Duomo, and therefore fix, like in a coat of arms, the Duomo at Como as that high point that we've seen in the history of the town. But it is its place, if you want, the place of the word of the church, of the liturgy, of the propagation of the word, is now the propagation, multiplication, and propaganda of the word effected with machines of communication, with the portable typewriter, with the loudspeaker, with the direct address to the people. And the Segretario Federale is the one who is sitting in this sanctum of power. Here resides, in other words, the highest local representative. Here is the symbolic fulcrum of power, and coalescing in the image of Mussolini and the typewriter. And here only, and this is interesting, is the post, the vertical column. And I'm so sorry I can't show this to you in a real photograph, although I took the photograph illegally because you're not supposed to photograph this building. It's occupied by the finanze, by the police that's investigating any kind of infraction of financial and customs law in Italy. Therefore, it's strictly forbidden to photograph, but I've photographed this, an anonymous photograph. Because the point is now almost obscured, but it's fundamental. And the point is that column is the only column in the whole building that has not been either stuccoed over or clad in stone, as all others are. It represents, in fact, what Le Corbusier was famous for saying, splendeur du béton brut. It celebrates, as we in the new parlance in America in the last 20 years, you celebrate everything, right? Celebrate is a kind of key word. When I went to Poughkeepsie a couple of years ago and saw one of the most dead downtowns that ever existed, there were big banners hanging in the parking lots and in front of boarded up houses that said, celebrate downtown. Now, how you do that is hard to imagine, but if you can live with that, then you can certainly easily live with the celebration that's presented here. And the celebration, of course, is to celebrate the raw, coarse, the uncouth nature of cement as it stands naked, we would use the word before you, and Perani wrote in his accompanying text to this, that this lo stato grezzo, which means the rude and crude state of the cement, represents political violence, drive, and power. And therefore, in a glass case affixed to this column, there were the blood-stained garments of those posses of early fascist hooligans and thugs who helped the party come power. And this is an absolutely astounding thing, and something that every time I think of it again, in a sense, leaves me breathless. It namely implies a whole series of ideas that are at the heart of this operation. The building, in its external appearance, not only suggests an incredibly fine-tuned resolution of all the built-in problems that result from the very concept of the building. You look at this and you think it is a precision watch. It's something that can occupy a mind like Peter Asman for 40 years until he's really figured out how it ticks. That's one thing. So a building that almost singularly in this period exhibits the most delicate and rational mechanism of its own generation. It moreover confirms that and sublimates it by cladding every visible square inch of its entire surface, no exception, entire surface, in marble. This was a decision made once the building had already been started, and therefore costly and difficult adjustments had to be made to fit the marble that varies from 8 centimeter to 2.5 centimeter thickness in order to create an absolutely smooth surface, notwithstanding the inevitable irregularities that resulted in the sort of cast concrete building in the early 1930s. So the building from the outside is clad in the material of temples. Its geometry is as worked out and refined as that of an ancient temple. Only inside, where the holder of the power, the executive cog in the machine, sits every day, is the true nature of this entire reality nakedly present in the form of a crude, cast, rough column of cement. So you could say that only those who hold the power can really stomach its nature. Something that maybe is in fact a test how you get there. All the others who have to go out to vomit can't stay in the game, right? Or revolt against it. So that's it. On the one hand, it says that the true nature of the power is revealed only to those who hold it. And on the other side, it says that the true nature of power in its public manifestation is one of continually establishing harmony, order, brilliance, splendor, beauty, abundance, etc. I've used my time badly. See you tonight.